Did Paul teach that the law is done away? We had a sermonette last week by Carl Hill. I had this one already planned, so I thought, well, maybe that's what we need again. But did Paul teach that the law is done away? That's what most of the churches teach. I want to have us turn to 1 Corinthians 9, first of all. 1 Corinthians 9. And I'm going to read verse 9 when I find it here. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 9. Okay. For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treads out the corn. And then Paul asked, does God really concern himself with the oxen in that way? I mean, he wants us to treat animals right, but and we're not supposed to abuse them, but why did he give this law? He tells us in the next verse that he gave it for Christians of his day, and it carries right on down to Christians of our day. Verse 10. Or saith it altogether, for our sakes, for our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that plows should know, or should plow in hope, and that he that reaps in hope should be partaker of his hope. In other words, don't hold someone back from doing their work and enjoying the good things of their labor. Turn over to, and that law can be found, we won't turn there, but it can be found in Deuteronomy 25, verse 4. Let's turn over to 1 Timothy 5. Verse 18. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox that treads the out. So in other words, Paul reiterated or reused the law in many of his writings. And read verse 19 then of First Timothy 5. And against an elder, receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses. Well, that's part of God's law too. You can't put anyone to death, or you can't account anyone guilty of a crime unless there are two or three witnesses. Okay. So Paul used other scriptures, and Carl showed us some last week. I'll be showing more. But while we're this close, let's turn over to Galatians 3. This scripture is used by many to say God has done away with the law. I want Galatians 3, verse 13. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. And many will stop there. Well, let's go on. Being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. Well, if they read that, they kind of ignore it. They don't know really what it's leading to. But they will begin building their sermon around the fact that the law itself is this curse that God put on us. And Jesus Christ freed us from that curse of the law. But if they would just go back to verse 10 and read the context, they might have a little different perspective on what Paul is saying in verse 13. Verse 10, for as many as are under the works of the law are under the curse. Well, what does that mean? Well, he goes ahead and explains it. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continues not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. So the curse of the law is on those who do not obey the law. That's quite simple if you read that verse and connect it with verse 13. Let's turn back then to and see where Paul got this idea. I mean, where did Paul get the idea that the curse is brought on people by disobedience? Let's turn back to Deuteronomy verse 20 or chapter 27. Deuteronomy 27. And I'm not going to read all these verses. You can read them yourself if you want to take the time. But I'm going to start in verse 14. And the Levites shall speak and say unto the men of Israel with a loud voice, cursed be the man that makes a graven image or molden, a graven or molden image. And you can read on down all these verses, and it tells you, a man is cursed when he breaks God's law. He comes over here in chapter 28 and begins again in verse 16. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field, and cursed shall you basket and your store. In other words, you can read these two chapters, and you can see why God, or rather Paul, wrote what he did here in verse 10. But we can see an almost quote from Deuteronomy. Let's go to chapter 27 again. And read the last verse, verse 26. It sounds almost exactly like verse 10 of Galatians 3. Cursed be he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them. So the person who will not do God's law suffers the curse of the law. Well, Christ did deliver us from the curse of the law. And Paul explains that quite well in Romans. He says he can't do anything right. He just keeps messing up, and he wants to do the right of God's law. And we all do. I would love myself to be perfect. I would truly love to be perfect. One of these days I hope I will be. I have that hope. But we keep doing things that are against God's law. But in Romans verse chapter 8, and let's turn there, Romans 8. Romans 8, verse 1. He says, there is therefore. Whoop, well, you got to go back into verse, or chapter 20. I'm sorry. You got to go back into chapter 7 to find out what he's saying therefore about, right? But let's go ahead and read verse 1. There is therefore, because of what he said, now no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus. There's a stipulation, however. Not faith only. Not just believing and confessing with your mouth and believing in your heart and you're saved. He says, for those who walk not after the flesh of willful sin, but after the Spirit. Well, how do you walk after the Spirit? Paul told us up here in chapter 27, verse 22, that he delights in God's law in the inward man, in his heart. Verse 25, he says, in his mind he obeys it. And that's where God will put his law when you accept his new covenant, which we are under. Puts it in our heart and mind. So if we walk in the spirit of the law, doing our very best to obey it, we're not under the curse of the law. So if someone ever uses that scripture now to try to get you and convince you to think that, hey, we don't have to obey the law, if you've taken notes or if you can remember what you need to do here, show them that, hey, nope, that does not say that the law is a curse. Disobedience to the law brings the curse, the punishment. Okay.
It's a beautiful day. You get the feeling that as we're like 8 days from the beginning of that seventh month in the Hebrew calendar and the fall holy days, fall is starting to show itself. It's gorgeous out there. The title of the message today is, Why Keep the Feast Where God Requires? So why does God require us to go to the feast? We're going to try to look a little deeply into that topic today. And what does the Bible reveal? My first thought is, anything that God says is good for us. Like, God's laws and principles are good for us. So it's for our benefit. And I think the first benefit is like a bond or seal or glue It's like a sign to hold us to the true God. Let's go to Exodus 31. It's one of the understandings of the Sabbaths that I don't think the world obviously does not understand. And, of course, God allows that. He's letting the world do its own thing, except for a small called out few. Exodus 31, we're going to look at verse 12. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, verse 13, Exodus 31. Speak you also unto the children of Israel, saying, verily, my Sabbaths. I want to emphasize two words, my. That is, it's God's Sabbaths. It's not the Jews' Sabbaths or the nation of Judah's Sabbath. It's God. anyway, and the L-O-R-D, that's the capital letters. It means, well, I think, depends on which scholar you look at. It could be Yahweh. It could be Yehovah, Yahweh, Yahweh, and maybe a couple other possibilities. But it's the ancient God of Israel. They are His Sabbaths, the Creator God, the Eternal God, and the word and the Sabbaths plural. And the reason I throw in the plural there, because there's a weekly Sabbath every week. But when you put in the S, it's plural. That means they're annual Sabbaths and weekly Sabbaths. All of them belong to God, and all of them are keys to that better relationship with God. Anyway, finish reading it. Verily, my Sabbath, plural, you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generation, that you may know that I am the Lord, and that's that word, Jehovah or Yahweh, Yahweh, the God of Israel, that does sanctify you. Now think about it. It's a sign. So the Sabbath is a sign of the God you worship. And I know the world means well, so this is not to be critical. But when Constantine took Christianity and made it the official religion of the Roman Empire, I guess it became the Holy Roman Empire, they and I guess their committee and others, they adjusted Christianity to fit pagan Rome. Rome worshipped the sun god. So they moved services over to the day of the sun god. I'm sure it was gradual. There's more to that story. But the point I'm making is it took the focus off the true God. Now, I know the world doesn't know that. So, you know, if you tell your relatives, they probably will just, who cares? That's generally what people say. But God cares. That's what makes it important. Verse 17, it is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Why should God have to change his mind because the Roman Empire didn't want the Sabbath? For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and refreshed. God made it holy by resting on that day. Do you realize that you can't make a day holy? You can start your own religion. And let's say I want to start my own religion. There are people who do that, and I want to make Wednesday, you know, which they call hump day. I want to make that our Sabbath. Well, I could do that. We can make our own little rules, but we really can't make anything holy. Only God can make time holy. A lot of churches have their little summer campouts, revivals, and, you know, it may do them some good, but they really can't make it holy. Only God can do that. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16:16. A verse that no doubt we'll hear more about as time goes on. Deuteronomy 16:16. By the way, the book of Deuteronomy, as the Israelites were getting ready to cross into the promised land, they got to spend an extra time in the verdant plains on the other side of the Jordan River. And Moses finished writing the five books. And Deuteronomy was kind of a recapitulation of the law, but with some additional fine-tuning. One of the fine-tunings he put in there, he also told them they weren't supposed to sacrifice even the Passover within their gates, but which you'll see in verse 5. And there's a 500-page book that fights that in all kinds of clever ways. But let's look at verse 16. 3 times a year shall all your males appear before the Lord your God in the place where he shall choose. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that's one, and the Feast of Weeks. By the way, weeks is Passover. Pentecost. It's actually 7 weeks, 49 days, plus one is 50. So in Greek, that's Pentecost. Pentecost is the Feast of Weeks. And the Feast of Tabernacles, what we call the Fall Holy Days. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty. So you go to the place that God chooses. God, I believe, does that to strengthen us and to strengthen that relationship. But also, I believe God's holy days reveal the plan of God. Those three seasons that you see mentioned, Deuteronomy 16:16, they're a key to knowing the plan of God, and they help give us more truth and more inspiration. As you probably know, when HWA joined the Church of God, Missouri Conference, and they had a little group up there in Oregon, the Oregon grouping of that conference, there was some books floating around, including one written at the turn of the 20th century, about keeping the holy days. And there was some debate in the group about doing it. Well, HWA decided to do it. Everybody didn't agree. He decided to do it. And then, of course, his son came along with his great speaking skills, and the whole thing expanded. And that led to what we now call the Golden Age of the Worldwide Church of God. But one of the reasons for the Golden Age of the Worldwide Church of God, and much of the truth that's out there on the Internet came out of the Golden Age of the Worldwide Church of God, was because HWA kept the holy days. They are a key to greater truth. And we went to Ambassador College, and you start following the message of those holy days, and more truth just unveils itself, like the final judgment of mankind and the last great day. But, and of course, you're going to ask yourself, why did he say in the place where God sets his name? And I think the third part of that message is quality control. The reason God wanted them to go to the place, originally, of course, it was the tabernacle where the high priest Aaron and all the Levitical priests were, is I call it quality control, to prevent bad religious influences from getting in. Now, the Levites were supposed to be trained in the Bible and in certain health laws and health principles. And of course, as you all know, they're very smart. Most people realize how smart. Just look at all the Levites that are top scientists and lawyers today. So God actually gifted them. And I think that's pretty clear if you look at it logically. But where do you want to be at the feast? Where the trained teachers are. Now, later it was Jerusalem, and for many, 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 many centuries, Jerusalem was the place where the temple was. Well, I want to ask the question, what about the New Testament church? Because it gets different. So let's ask the question, what about the New Testament church? There are at least two scriptures that I think will help us understand it. First of all, remember that as the church expanded, it wasn't just a relatively small nation of Jerusalem where within a few days' travel, most people could get to Jerusalem. The church expanded into Asia, Europe, North America. Some people, I know a guy at our school says it went to India too, the eastern half of India. But regardless, we know for sure it expanded into Asia, Europe, and North Africa. Okay, so what about the church in the expanded Roman Empire? Well, there are two revealing scriptures. I want to go to 1 Corinthians 5, and I'll explain it, and I think we can get a good understanding of it. You just have to get the worldly religious doctrines out of your mind because they'll confuse you. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7 and 8. The reason this is important is this is clearly a primarily Gentile church, probably at least roughly 1,000 miles from Jerusalem, maybe even more. But by travel in those days, it was out of reach in any pragmatic sense for most people most of the time. 1 Corinthians 5. And so they were not Jews. They were far from the Middle East. And they were mostly Gentiles. So if, and this is long after Christ was nailed to the stake. So all the excuses for switching to the Roman Empire days and getting away from what they would call Jewish days wouldn't apply. Notice what Paul says, verse 7. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven. Now, Paul knew when his letter arrived, they'd be keeping the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And it's quite clear when you read it. There's no other way you can read this. Also in chapter 11, he also addresses the New Testament Passover as well. So it's clear this letter was, he knew it would arrive during the days of unleavened bread, and he knew they'd be keeping them. How did he know they'd be keeping them? Because he founded the church, Acts 18, which we'll get to in a few minutes. He says, purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened. How did he know they were unleavened? Because he taught them to put the leaven out of the house. And as Coney Barnhouse and two great scholars say, you can play games with these verses, but if you're being logical, they were unleavened. It's the only way to logically look at it. Because otherwise, simile wouldn't work. You know, leaven, sin, wouldn't work any other way. For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. Now, what feast does he have in mind? Maybe Halloween? Ishtar, Easter? No, it's clear. If we're going to be logical now, keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I mean, is there another way you're going to... I mean, people play games with words, but you can't get out of it. Therefore, let us, these Gentile Christians, keep the feast. Not with old leaven, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. But there's another verse, Acts 18, that is revealing. Some of the modern translations leave the holy day out of it, trying to get around it. So it depends on which translation you have. But here's the King James, Acts 18, verse 20. Acts 18, 20. When they desired him to tarry longer with them, he didn't stay. They said, Paul, come on, can't you stay longer with our church? Paul said, but he bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes in Jerusalem, but I will return again with you. So what I think happened is there were regional feast sites like Corinth, where the Corinthians kept the holy days. But obviously, as long as Jerusalem stood, the bigger feast was in Jerusalem. And if you could get the time and could go, and probably some could, you'd go there. They believe there are 15,000 Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. Well, at least that's an estimate of one commentary. And I don't know how they figured that out, but it's probably reasonably accurate. They probably took a certain section of the temple area, courtyard, amphitheaters, and probably in different rented buildings around Jerusalem. They probably had a great feast there in Jerusalem. Probably a great feast. And that was, of course, quite a trip. But let's face it, Jerusalem, within a few years after these books were written, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans when the Jews rebelled. The Christians fled because they remember what Christ said when you see armies around Jerusalem. When Titus pulled back, the Christians left. And the Jews stayed, and horrible things happened. Okay, after Jerusalem was destroyed, and there was no temple there, what did God's church do? Did they just say, oh, well, we can't do anything now? Of course not. They just maintained the regional feast sites within reasonable travel distance of people. They probably had them in Corinth and some of the other cities, you know, throughout the Roman Empire where there are enough Christians, probably Alexandria and other places. Because they are mentioned indirectly in other parts of the Bible, even later on, afterwards. But here's what we know from church history, a book that actually was written at the beginning of the 20th century. Dr. Hay kind of added a little bit more to it, and it was available during the Golden Age worldwide, the true history of the true church. And what they did, they went through history and they looked for signs of Sabbath keeping and Feast of Tabernacles keeping, to look for the small underground church. Because mostly when you go to history book and you look up Christianity, they show you the Roman Catholic Church. And obviously they had a dominant part in the whole world history, which we all know about, all the popes and all the stuff that they did. And they found at one time there were, I won't go through all the details, I just want to mention a few. They found in Switzerland the Waldensians. They had several thousand members. And for a generation or so, they kept the feast in Switzerland and had many of the very same doctrines we have from what evidence. And then they found examples of people keeping the feast in Great Britain and then later in America, which is all logical if you think about it. And as I mentioned the other day, when that prediction of the end of the world didn't come true and there was all kinds of divisions, one group stayed at the Church of God, and that's the group that eventually Herbert Armstrong came in touch with like 80, 90 years later. But a lot of other groups sprang out of that, Seventh-day Adventist, the church, I get their name right, the Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints, the Jehovah's Witnesses. So there was a lot of Bible interest, that's all I'm saying, that existed. And you can see evidence of those things in the past. And, of course, Herbert Armstrong decided, this goes way, way back, you know, to the 1930s and 40s, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And actually, Ambassador College was built out of the Feast of Tabernacles. I'm simplifying the story, but you can read about it. One of the big feast sites he got from the Hammer family was some property in Big Sandy, Texas, which eventually became Ambassador College. Anyway, I'm going with all the stuff that's all happening. They got some stuff in Pasadena. And the golden age of the Worldwide Church of God really was built around keeping the Feast of Tabernacles that helped unify the church. And then they got the college. They developed more ministers. And obviously, Satan came in a generation or two later and undermined it, which Satan, that book also shows that's happened before many times. Otherwise, the church would be very, very big. And that's unfortunate, but we're still here, right? The devil may have thrown monkey wrenches in the works, but we're still here, and that's all that counts. And I believe greater things are coming. Let's just look at those three holy day periods, just real briefly. We'll have more time to discuss them in the Bible studies, the fall ones, when we do our fall Feast of Trumpets and Atonement. But let's look at them real quickly. Take the Passover and unleavened bread. You realize the original Israelites had to get inside their house before dark, and they had to put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, like covering the house, if you like that. The death angel came over, and if it saw the blood of the lamb, it passed over them, and they didn't die. Well, what covers over our sins, as Mr. Edwards mentioned? The blood of the lamb. It's the same principle. That lamb that died in Egypt was just representative of Jesus Christ. And he died on the afternoon of the 14th, just when Christ died, the afternoon of the 14th. The Jews will realize that when the time comes. The true Lamb of God, and it will be for the whole world in the very near future, is Christ. In the days of unleavened bread, you try to get out of sin, like the Israelites left Egypt during the days of unleavened bread. We leave the world of sin. At least it's symbolic. Pentecost, that was also the giving of the law, which you need to direct you toward righteousness. Pentecost, God empowered the church. Think about it. When Christ left, he told his disciples to stay in Jerusalem and wait for the Spirit to empower the church. Why, if God wanted to do away with the annual holy days, why not give him the power right then? You know, God does everything to fit his holy days. He's very methodical. We'll probably see it in the end, looking back, more than we can see it now. But the day of Pentecost has fully come. They're all together celebrating it, and the Holy Spirit empowered them, Acts chapter 2. Then the fall holy days. Now, they haven't actually happened in world history yet, but we can look forward to the trumpets. And we're going to talk about more of this, the Feast of Trumpets, Monday the 17th. And we'll look at trumpets and the return of Jesus Christ and the last great day, the final opportunity for mankind. All that is coming up, and we're going to see it more clearly because we're keeping God's holy days. I call them the annual Sabbaths. And we should keep them in the places that God sets for us. Like food inspectors, you want to eat where there are food inspectors, where the food is clean. Paganism was always creeping into Israel. Like us, it's like creeping vines, like a disease. Every time they turned around, paganism got in there and messed them up because human nature tends to like. I can't explain why human nature likes decadence and paganism, but it does. And there's no way you can read the Old Testament and come to any other conclusion. Let's just look a little at this, 1 Kings 12. There's actually many things you could say about it, but let's go to 1 Kings 12. And we're going to look at these kinds of influences. 1 Kings 12, verse 26. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David." By the way, this is an interesting story. God tore the nation of Israel in half and gave 10 tribes to Jeroboam because Solomon fell away. He would have done it in Solomon's day, but because he loved David so much, he wouldn't do it then, but would do it later. And three tribes, if you count Levi, went with David. Now, if Jeroboam had trusted God, he could have said, I can let the people go to Jerusalem for the feast like they do all the time and trust that God is going to keep me on this throne because God told me, a prophet of God told him. But you know how human nature is? He didn't have the faith to trust God. He started doing human thinking, like, well, if they go back to Jerusalem, they're going to want to go back to David's line of kings. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, they shall the heart of this people turn again unto the Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So he counseled with his advisors, and they told him to build, verse 25, statues in Bethel and Dan of calves. Do you remember the Israelites when they first, Moses first went up the mountain with the tablets in his hands? He came back there worshiping the golden calf. It makes you wonder, didn't Jeroboam know about that? Or if he did know, he didn't care. He did exactly what the Israelites did when Moses was away. When the cat's away, the mice will play. The same thing. He did it, and he changed the location to Bethel and Dan, which were more convenient. They'd get there before they got to Jerusalem. And this thing became a sin. In other words, it was bad for the people of the northern 10 tribes. But the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan, and he made a house of high places. In other words, and these high hills where the pagans did all their pagan ceremony, he did the same. He made priests of the lowest of the people who were not the sons of Levi. In other words, he hired men who would teach anything for money. They would pervert any doctrinal truth. They would teach anything for money. And they probably didn't really know the Bible that well. The Levites did, because that was part of their duty to educate the people and educate their kids and that sort of thing. And they didn't know. And he also changed the calendar. You go to verse 32, move the feast to the eighth month. He messed with the calendar. He messed with the location and the calendar and basically changed the religion to a counterfeit. Now, he didn't say that this is a false god. He kind of blended worship of the calf with worship of the true God. In my mind, I have a hard time imagining it, how that would have been done, but that's what he did. They say pagan gods often stood on calves. That's what one commentary said. For me, it's hard to believe you're going to put a golden idol and say, this is the God that brought us out of Egypt. This is the God of our ancestry. But that's what he did. And it was a sin and led to the decadence and destruction of the northern ten. If you read the history of the northern ten tribes, they didn't last that long. All of their kings were bad, bad, worst ever, bad, the very worst, Jezebel, the worst. And they had no revivals. Judah had many revivals. Judah often went back and had many prosperous days. The pathway back to God was cut off because they changed the holy days, they changed the location of where to worship, and they put in those false idols. The structure was gone for any inspiration. So when we keep God's days at the right time and the right place, we have the structure for inspiration to inspire us. And you never know. You might think, well, I'm doing pretty good. Maybe you are, but you're going to need that extra boost that hopefully the Feast of Tabernacles will give us. So number one, I believe these holy days bind us to the Creator God of the Bible. It's like a link to the real God. And they reveal His plan, which is a guide and hopefully an inspiration to us. And you have to do it in the right places, at the right time, and in the right way. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. But it's amazing if you compare the history of the northern ten with the history of Judah. That was a terrible sin when they changed the locations and the places and the time of religion. It was just one disaster. And I'm sure the devil was very happy about it. Encouraged it all he could. You can just imagine the advisors around the king, Jeroboam, and how they thought about it. and the devil's influence. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? Require of you, but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him and serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. That's quoted in the New Testament, by the way. That's not new. They were quoting Deuteronomy. It's also in Leviticus, too. To keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you this day for your good. I want to emphasize the word for your good. I know it doesn't seem that way when you read the Bible, but actually God doesn't need anything from us. It's like, do you remember, if those of you remember the Tinkerbell story, one of those Peter Pan ones, and Tinkerbell's running out of inspirational magic. And all the kids, at least the way one version, has to clap for her and applaud for her to get the inspirational magic to get her going again. Anyway, those of you who've seen it know what I mean. God doesn't really need that. You think, well, we got to worship there, or God loses all this. No, God is going to be fine. He's powerful. He doesn't need it. This worship, the way he wants, where he wants, and when he wants, is for our good. I mean, certainly it makes God happy, and it's good for God to be happy, but it's for our good, and I want to try to make that point. It's for our good. You may not see it. Every one of God's law in some way, shape, or form are for our benefit. Like someone was telling me the other day that if you keep the health laws of God, including not drinking blood, not touching dead bodies, or if you do, wash your hands very good, and burying garbage and eating clean meat, you will live 7 to 8 years longer than the average American. Wow, it's for our benefit. And probably we'll be healthier during much of that time, too. Anyway, and a lot of people laugh at those laws. Oh, I can eat all the shellfish and pork I want, and I'm as healthy as everybody else. And I guess it looks that way. But a lot of things you just can't see because they're too subtle to see, humanly speaking. Deuteronomy 12, verse 2. And when they came into the land, here's what God told them. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall possess serve their God upon the high mountains, upon the hills, and upon under every green tree. Under these mountaintops, actually there's one at a Catholic hospital near us, so I think I know what they look like. They have like a little at the top, certain bushes and trees, and they have a little thing, and this one now, it's a statue, a religious statue, and a little urn there. Apparently, they had these and other things all over Canaan as the Israelites came in, and God said, destroy them, burn them, tear them down. I want any of the pagan names, any of the pagan place, I want all the paganism gotten rid of because it led those people to decadence and terrible things. And you shall overthrow their altars, verse 3, break their pillars, burn their groves. Most versions will use the word Asherah, but King James doesn't. The Asherah with poles. And you shall hew down the graven images of their gods, destroy the names of them out of that place. You might ask, what is an Asherah and other religious poles? Some of them are phallic symbols. And Asherah was the goddess of fertility, and she was the consort of Baal and most of those other gods. They had male and females, and actually their gods were like a soap opera. You read about the Greek and Roman gods, and a lot of it, like, it's like reading a soap opera. They brought the gods down to man's level, but you might ask, why Easter is the anglicized version of the word Ishtar, Easter. Why do they have the little eggs at Easter? Because it's a fertility goddess. And rabbits are very, you know, prolific. In case you wonder how that all came about. And they did terrible things in those places. They really did. They actually sold little girls and boys into temple prostitution. They, one commentary said, let's say if somebody had unwanted children because of, you know, it's a form of birth control if you view it that way. They had unwanted babies and stuff. They could simply give it to the pagan gods, and they burn them up. I can't, you know, you can read about it in historic books, really gruesome stuff. And they unearth a lot of pagan temples, and they go to the cornerstone. They'll see a lot of little tiny skulls. They thought that was good luck. I mean, terrible things. They killed thousands of babies. And by the way, the women they sold in the temple prostitution, according to some of what I've read and heard, it wasn't like some older woman who's 20 years old, and she says, I think I want to make money as a prostitute. No, most of them were sold by their parents or given to their parents because they thought it would bring them good luck. Girls 9, 10, and 11, and boys too, to be temple prostitutes. Think about how horrible that is. And there are other bad things, superstitious things, black magic. All those went with paganism, and that's why God said totally destroy it. Because when God brings them back in the next life, they'll be in a controlled atmosphere where, you know, they won't be able to do all that weird pagan stuff. And so, because you may wonder, well, what happened to all the people that God got rid of? Well, God will take care of them in the last great day, and they'll be in a controlled atmosphere where they'll learn righteousness and won't be under all these bad influences. Verse 4, you shall not do so unto the Lord your God. In other words, when you get to all those pagan groves atop of hills and pagan temples, destroy them, and don't worship your God in the same way they worship their God. But unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes and put his name there, even unto his habitation shall you seek, and thither shall you come. So God wanted them to go where he told them to go. Verse 13, take heed to yourself, Deuteronomy 12:13. Take heed to yourself that you offer not burnt offerings in every place that you see. In other words, they'll go to this little town. They'll see a hill where there was a sacred grove and sacred trees and totem poles or their pagan Canaanite version of totem poles and phallic symbols. And also they had little, you can find throughout the Middle East, little idols that show the goddess Ishtar with her breast bare and her hands like this, right under her breast. And apparently that was a big deal in the ancient world. We probably laugh at all these idols, but in the ancient world it was a big deal. Take heed that you offer not burnt offerings in every place that you see, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of the tribes, there shall you offer burnt offerings, and there shall you do all that I command you. The question is, why does God not want them to do what the pagans are doing? Because it's bad for them. And the most pagan countries generally have the worst governments and the most oppressed people. I'm generalizing. There are some exceptions. But you look at most of the world, I'd say last 500, 600, 700 years, you go to the places where they're most pagan, least amount of Bible, there's more superstition, and the people are more oppressed and poor. Less blessed. And I see it fairly clearly. I know you could, there are exceptions, and you know, maybe everything isn't so always so clear, but I can clearly see it there. And so you're going to ask, so why doesn't our church keep Ishtar and Christmas and Halloween? Really? Because we recognize where it came from. By the way, when it comes around this year, they don't even make secrets of it anymore. They admit it comes from paganism. Paganism is now in. It used to be out. It's now in. You'll read in the newspaper. I almost bet next spring you'll read some of the pagan traditions of Easter, some of the pagan traditions of Christmas. You probably already know the story that actually in America, Christmas was not that well kept until a couple decades after the Civil War when certain merchants realized how valuable it was. And some of those merchants were Jewish, by the way, which is, I don't know, that's an interesting story. By the way, George Washington, when he was really down, his Christmas Day attack on the Hessians kind of helped turn public opinion. Because the American colonists didn't keep Christmas, but the Hessians, who were German mercenaries working for the British, did. So he knew they'd be drunk. Right? I mean, I'm oversimplifying. I'm sure what he did was more heroic, but it's interesting to know that. Verse 29, Deuteronomy 12, verse 29. When the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you, will you go to possess them, and you shall succeed as them and dwellest in their land, Take heed to yourself that you be not snared by following them after they be destroyed from before you. And you inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. But if you read most newspapers, probably in December and in the spring, can't you see society is interested in earth worship, which is one part of paganism, and pagan culture and pagan tribes? I almost see more of a, at least among the far left, a glorification of mankind's pagan nature worship and a disdain for the Bible and Christianity. I see it going more and more and more every year. It's almost as if people are saying, well, how did these pagans of past generations celebrate God? Maybe we ought to do the same. God said, don't do it. You shall not do so unto the Lord your God. For every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, have they done unto their God. For even their sons and their daughters, they burnt in the fire to their gods. That's what they did. And God hates it. And it reminds God of all those things. And while I'm not, you know, all that afraid of Ishtar or any of those other days, you know, and I know they mean well, so I'm not worried about them or anything of that nature. But we don't do those things because it reminds God of things he doesn't want to be reminded of. And it's really not good for people. It gets the focus off the deeper meaning of the Bible. Very few, well, at least I was in the Baptist church for years, I had very few on Easter. For instance, I had very few deep sermons about Jesus Christ. Now, maybe some churches do give them, but most of them don't. I mostly remember coloring eggs. And I love, and I still love, marshmallow chocolate eggs. Okay, let me throw in a corny joke here. This dog walks into this office, and he points with his paw to the sign saying, job. The guy says, hey, you're a dog. You got to be able to use a computer to take this job. The dog jumps over to the computer. There's a little pause. He types out something and opens up some programs, pushes enter, and out comes a printout. He grabs his mouth, takes it to the guy, says, wow, you got the computer to work. Well, you have to be able to type letters. The guy hops off, runs over to the computer. He types a nice little letter, a little message, brings it over to the guy. The guy says, but you're a dog. The dog runs over to the sign with his paw and points to the part that says, equal opportunity employer. Equal opportunity employer. The guy says, well, yeah, but the sign also says, it also says you have to be bilingual. The dog stops. He turns, looks at the guy, and he says, meow. I know that's a corny story, but I like corny stories. But in a way, the dog was simple. It's bark or meow. Real simple. And I think in some ways, God is saying, obeying me is simple. Just simply keep my holy days the way I want you to, the weekly Sabbath, the annual Sabbath, and you'll get more truth. You'll be better connected to me. I'm not going to read these verses, but if you go to 1 Kings 14, 22 to 24, Judah had this problem, and one of the kings, actually happened a number of times, said, we'll let the people sacrifice any way they want to on all the high hills. Sure enough, they started bringing in all those pagan things like Astarte. You go, why? I can't even explain it, but they started going back into that nature worship, the goddess worship, Moloch, Baal, and God got quite upset at Judah for it. It's like letting people do whatever they want in any high hill proved a disaster. And decadence and disaster seemed to follow. Well, let's say, what about Jesus Christ? Now, there's a story about when he was 12 and he went to the feast in Jerusalem and talked to the priest. You all know that and how he wowed them. But I want to talk about another story about Jesus Christ and the feast. Let's go to John 7. And if you have questions about John's, or the way John worded it, I think John words it the way he does because the feast was run by the Jewish. By the time John wrote his book, well, at least some people believe that most of the church was in the Gentile world and maybe the Jews were already scattered out of Jerusalem. But even if not, most of the John's writing would have been read by Gentiles in the Roman Empire. So he's describing the feast that the Jews ran during the... Of course, the church didn't exist when Christ was alive. The church came after Christ died, as you know. So even though it's a Jewish feast, I still want to make a point here. What did Christ do? John 7, verse 1. After these things, Jesus walked not in Galilee. Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry. In other words, the lower part of that land, where the closer to Jerusalem, he didn't go there. He stayed up in, you might call, in the hill country in Galilee, where it's from, because the Jews sought to kill him. So the feast was coming up, and his family members, who at that time weren't converted, they said, well, you know, aren't you going to get in the caravan and go up to the Feast of Tabernacles like you always do? And he said, no, I'm not going because they're out to kill me. Here's what I bet happened. Probably when the caravans came down from Galilee, they probably had temple police or whatever they called them. And they probably, oh yeah, that's the ones that Jesus' relatives in. They probably searched it looking for him to kill him. I mean, they pretty much decided that he was a danger to them. They were jealous of him. They actually were afraid of Christ, if you can believe it. The leadership was. Because a lot of people wanted to make him king, and they were out to get him. And he embarrassed them so many times, they even stopped asking him questions. They were really out, and they didn't really care. They're out to assassinate him, even though that wasn't legal, but that's what they wanted to do. So Jesus didn't come up till later. He came up secretly. Now, the point I want to make, if you're looking for an excuse to not go to the feast, they're out to kill me. What's a great better excuse you can get than that? He came up secretly. Let's go to verse 10. But when the brethren were gone up, then went he also up unto the feast, but not openly, but as it were in secret. Probably didn't go in the caravan that he was expected to be in. Like a secret agent. And by the way, apparently Jesus looked enough like normal Jewish people that he didn't have a halo and a spotlight on his head like the stained glass window I grew up watching. So they couldn't spot him out of a big crowd. So he was there, but they didn't know where he was. To the feast, but not openly, but in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast, and they said, where is he? And there was much murmuring among the people, because they wanted to grab him and kill him, concerning him. For some said, he's a good man. Others said, no, he deceives the people. But they weren't able to speak about him openly, because if the Pharisees saw that you were too friendly to Jesus, you were in trouble. And the scribes, that's how it was. But he was the topic du jour of the moment. Now, about the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. So all of a sudden, he hops up on stage and starts preaching. Let's go to verse 25. And how he didn't get killed then, it's not clear. But obviously, God didn't want it to happen, so it didn't happen. Verse 25. And then said some of them of Jerusalem, is not this he whom they seek to kill? People all knew. But lo, he speaks boldly. And they say nothing on him. Do the rulers know indeed that he is and the word Christ means Messiah, that he is the very Messiah? In other words, his preaching really impressed people. And they learned before not to openly challenge him, because every time they did, he embarrassed them. Let's go to verse 31. And many of the people believed on him and said, when Christ or the Messiah comes, will he do more miracles than these which this man does? And the Pharisees heard that the people murmured such things concerning him. You got to believe that scared the Pharisees and scribes to death. Because he criticized them very harshly and rejected them. And people were believing in him. And the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Verse 37. But obviously they didn't get him. In the last day, in that great day of the feast, the last great day, which is also a prophetic meaning when man gets their last chance for salvation. Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. Do you realize in the last great day, everybody who's ever lived that didn't have a chance for salvation will have one? Now, we're getting our chance for salvation now. As it says, judgment begins at the house of God. So we have to hang in there. In spite of the pressure of the world, we've got to hang in there. And I know we're not great. And we're not overly impressive, but God doesn't call the great and mighty. We have to just make the best of it. And God will take care of us, but we have to stay faithful. But the rest of the world will know Jesus Christ in that last great day. That must have been quite a sermon he preached. And Christ, verse 39, he that believes on me, as the scripture says, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living waters. What a great sermon that was. by the way, the leaders of the Pharisees asked their policemen, you know, who probably were in all the different courtyard meeting places, and so some of them had to be there when Christ got up on stage. I'll just pick it up in verse 44. And some of them would have taken him, but no man laid hands on him. Then came the officers to the chief priests and Pharisees, you know, the police officers, and they said unto them, why have you not brought him here? And the officers answered, verse 46, never a man spake like this man. In other words, Christ left the police officers just